Blog Talk Radio.
Family, it's time for the radio voice of Eastern Airlines to bring you more Eastern talk, news, and history of the greatest airline to ever fly the skies of our country, Eastern Airlines. Thanks for tuning in to this 313th live radio broadcast. And we're broadcasting from many areas around the country and listened to in over 40 countries around the world. My name is Jim Hart, and along with other hosts, we hope you'll share in the conversation tonight. After all, the show is for you and about you and Eastern Airlines. Neil, our producer, calls it kitchen table radio. And that's where I am right now, my kitchen table. Just a reminder about how to sign into the show and call in if you have comments, or if you want to join the host. Here's all you need to do. Go to www.ellradioshow.com and look for the radio icon on the home page. Click the arrow in the circle at 7 p.m. and you can listen on your computer. You can also tune in by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie, E-D-D-I-E. This site is the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio Show. Now, here's an easier way, probably what most people will do. Just call 213-816-1611 at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and you can listen right on your telephone. You can also join in the conversation by just saying, hey, hi. Since you've already on your phone, we want to hear from you. Now let's get this episode in the air along with a new Eastern airplane. Neil, what are we flying today?
Well, we'll tell you in just a minute. Let's get the engine started.
Tower Eastern 313 Heavy is ready for takeoff anytime.
Roger, Eastern 313 Heavy. Hey, what's that you guys are flying today? Is that a recent addition? And I also see a new destination. Congratulations.
Yeah, you're right on both counts. Of course, you've seen this aircraft before, but it's the first time in Eastern colors. It's a Douglas DC-10, and we're headed for London, England. The McDonnell Douglas DC-10 is a three-engine, wide-body jet airliner manufactured by McDonnell Douglas. The DC-10 has a range, medium to long-haul flight, capable of carrying a maximum of 380 passengers. It features two turbofan engines mounted on the underwing pylons and a third engine at the base of the vertical stabilizer in the back. This model was the successor to the McDonnell Douglas DC-8 for long-range operations and competes in the same market as our own L-1011 Lockheed TriStar, which is kind of similar in layout. Maximum takeoff weight is 555,000 pounds. Boy, that's a lot of metal getting in the air. Today's flight to London has all 380 seats filled. We have three Pratt & Whitney JT9Ds-59 engines developing 53,000 pounds of thrust each. This aircraft has a range of 5,750 miles, and our cruise speed is 564 miles per hour. That means we ought to reach Gatwick in approximately 7 hours and 4 minutes.
Easton 313 Heavy, good-looking airplane you got there, and you're cleared for takeoff on runway 8 right. The wind's out of the east at 10 knots. Thanks for the info.
Don?
We're on the roll.
8 right.
Okay, here we go. What a great history lesson we had on the last two broadcasts. The Atlanta Hartsfield Jackson International Airport was our topic and subject. Great show, and I suggest all our listeners to catch that on the archive. That was 311, episode 311 and 312. Tonight's episode is 313. Now, we'd like to introduce you to the several crew bases Eastern domiciled its pilots and flight attendants over the years. For this discussion, we've called in the experts to join us and tell us their knowledge of crew bases, chief pilots, and maintenance bases serving our great airline. Jim Holder is no stranger to our show, and he will help us tonight with crew bases and chief pilots, along with our mystery guest, but I'm going to tell you who that guest is right now, Captain Eston Fuller. Eston, nice having you with us, and I'll turn your microphone on in just a minute after we hear from Jim Holder. Chuck Albright will tell us about the maintenance bases, and we have, as I mentioned, Eston will be with us telling us more about chief pilots and bases, and he's almost a historian of Eastern. Love to go to Sun and Fun and just sit down and have a beer with Eston and enjoy the history lesson that he is so capable of telling. I used to, Eston, enjoy listening to Hassan Callaway. Of course, Hassan died a few years back, and we all like to sit around there at the QB hangar, have a beer, and share stories with Hassan Callaway. But tonight, We'll talk about the crew bases, and let's see how that works out. We've got a lot on tap tonight during our program, and we hope you'll stick around and hear some interesting stuff. And I always think of Kitchen Table Radio as a huge, very large kitchen table with Eastern families sitting around sharing stories. So that's what we're going to do tonight. Now let's bring in Captain Jim Holder to the EAL Radio Show's microphone to get things started. Jim Holder, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, start talking, Jim.
Okay. I understand we're going to talk about some of the crew bases and the chief pilots and everything, and I put together three or four stories here about, first one, if it's okay with you, I'd like to start off with a story about Captain Charlie Hamner. Is that okay with Neil?
That's fine.
Hamner,
I remember Charlie.
Yeah. He was a chief pilot before, I believe, Paul Kelly. And anyhow, this is a long time ago, and it's a true story. All my stories are true. We know that. And I was set up to fly a trip. My bid trip was Atlanta down to New Orleans and back to Atlanta and then up to Washington. I've forgotten who the captain was, but the morning, it was an afternoon trip, left about 1 o'clock, I think, out of Atlanta. And the captain was, like I said, I can't recall exactly who he was, but he called in sick around 10 o'clock that morning. And crew schedule called a reserve out, sort of a new captain named Stu Gleason. I'm sure you remember him, Neil. Stu got all screwed up, and he thought they were calling him for a trip tomorrow instead of at 1 o'clock today. And so we all reported in, and I'm going around. I was a co-pilot. I'm going around Atlanta operations looking for Stu Gleason, who I knew. I'd met him before, and I couldn't find him anywhere. And he didn't show up, and he didn't show up, and he didn't show up. So crew schedule called Charlie Hamner and told him we got a problem down here. We got an airplane load of people going to New Orleans, and we don't have a captain. So Charlie Hamner put on his coat, came down there to the gate, and walked in the airplane, and it was a 200. And the 200s were brand new at the time, and we had to go through a little ground school and some other stuff before we could fly them. And Charlie, I think, had gone through the ground school, but he hadn't flown the airplane. So he comes on and gets on board the airplane, sits down, looks over at me, and asks me if I'd flown it before. And I said, oh, Lord, yeah, I'm an expert on this airplane. You know, I've flown it twice. And he said, well, okay, you fly down to New Orleans and show me how it's done, and I'll fly it back. Is that okay? And I said, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. You know, of course, being the good co-pilot that I was. So we took off, load of people, went down to New Orleans where we found that the east-west runway, the long one, was closed. So we landed on runway 18 to the south. And everything went along normally. Everybody got off and everybody got back on. And we're going to taxi out and take off on 18, and which is not too long. And so Charlie, we went all the checklists, got everything lined up, and he shut the power up. And for those that you don't know, it had the same engines as a little 727, which were adequate for the little 7, but more than adequate. But for the 200, they sort of a little bit on the short side of power. So we go roaring down the runway, and the end of the runway is coming up, and Charlie's over there flying that thing, and all of us, you know, we just sort of lifted it off and rotated it, and off we went out across that airline highway and that motel down there, just really close to them. And I'm thinking to myself, this thing ain't right. There's something wrong here. We have full power, no ice, no nothing, you know. It was horrible performance on the takeoff. And Charlie looked over at me, and he, God almighty, he said, I don't know if I want to fly this airplane anymore. And I said, well, we got it going now, but I'm with you. This good Lord. So we turned out, and we flew up to Atlanta. We landed, taxied into the gate, and there was Stu Gleason standing in the jetaway waiting on us. They'd got him back there by then, and Charlie got up and turned around and said, well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it, and I'll turn this over to Stu Gleason, but I sure don't know if I like this airplane or not. And we said, thank you, Captain, and all that kind of stuff, and he walked out, and the second officer turned to me and said, God almighty. He said, you know what I did? He said, I gave you all the numbers for a 15-degree takeoff, and we're supposed to be doing a 25-degree takeoff. Now, the pilots out there know exactly what I'm talking about. That means you're going a lot slower when you lift the thing off. And I said, well, I ain't going to tell nobody if you don't tell nobody. But we ain't ever going to do this again. And he said, you're right. And that is a true story.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that well, that airplane, those engines on the stretched airplanes. I tell you what.
Yeah.
You really did some puckering toward the end of the runway.
That's a fact. That's a fact. But old Charlie, he probably, for about the next 2 weeks, he was telling everybody to call Boeing and ask them if we can cancel the order for the rest of those airplanes.
All right. Who else do you remember there in Atlanta while we got you here, Jim? And tell us some of the folks that you remember. I think you have another couple of stories that you'd like to talk about, chief pilot-wise.
Well, yeah, I got a couple of more. If somebody else wants to tell the story, I'll be glad to let them have it. Otherwise, I got another one. And this is not a real
I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and tell yours, and then we'll get to Eston to see if he can pick up on one or two.
All right. Well, this is not a funny, happy story, but it's about the chief pilot, and that was Wayne Hagler. And he was the chief pilot, and I was the ALPA council chairman. This is obviously much later than the one with Amber. And we had a real good working relationship. Obviously, this is before Lorenzo things got a little worse after that. But anyhow, I got a call from Wayne one night about 2 o'clock in the morning. And this is what it illustrates what sometimes you have to do when you're Alpha chairman and a chief pilot, the things that happen that aren't very, very well. But he told me that he had just got a call from crew schedule, and they said that the first officer on a trip in Seattle had not come down to the check-in, not check-in, but for the crew bus around 11 o'clock at night. You know, those Seattle trips left out there, some of them around midnight. Got into Atlanta about 10 o'clock, and he didn't come down. And, of course, this was back in the 83 time frame, I would say, right off the bat, and maybe 85. And they went up and were able to – he didn't answer any phone calls. He went up there, and they found the fellow, the co-pilot, in his bed. He was passed away. And Wayne told me that we've got the unpleasant task. You've got to come with me. We've got to tell his widow that she's a widow. And so I said, I'll be glad to help you, Wayne. And he said, well, put on your coat and tie, not a uniform, and we'll meet at Waffle House up there in North Atlanta, because I think they were in Marietta. I think it was Indian Hills. I'm not sure. And we went up there, and I'll tell you, we were both, this is something we'd never expect to have to do. And we went up there and found the house right at daylight, and we waited to see if anybody would come out neighbors-wise. And sure enough, about 7 o'clock, 6:30 or so, the next-door neighbor, this guy, came out and got in his car. And we went over and real quick told him what had happened and everything. And he said that, yeah, they knew this couple very well and that he was a friends with them. And Wayne asked him, well, does your wife know her well? He said, yes. He said, well, do you mind having her come with us? And she said, sure. So she put her clothes on and came over there, and we went up and knocked on the door. And it was a two-story house, and we saw her coming down the stairs. And as soon as she saw these two guys down there in suits and the next-door neighbor standing there, I think she knew exactly what we were there for. And it was one of the hardest things that I think I've ever done as a union representative, to be there to tell her, you know, that her husband had passed away on the layover. And so we were able to get inside the house, and I saw a church bulletin, and I asked the lady next door if she knew if that was their church, and she said yes. And we called the pastor and got him, and he came over. And not a good story, I know, but that just shows what sometimes you have to do when you're the chief pilot, as Wayne was, or council chairman, as I was. I've forgotten the guy's name. He was in his mid-40s.
I'm trying to think of the person, because I used to live in Indian Hills and in Marietta, or And in Marietta. So
I'm not positive it was Indian Hills, but I think it was. But it was up in that area, general area, and I wish I remembered the guy's name, but I don't. And I don't know how I'd go back and find it.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was around 1984, 85, somewhere like that.
Yeah. I've got Captain Eston Fuller on the line also. And Eston has been with Eastern many, many years and is a great pilot, a check captain, and instructor pilot on several different aircraft. And I just saw him here just a few days ago, a couple of days ago. At Lakeland Sun and Fun Air Show, which, by the way, if you've never been, you've really missed a great air show. And Eston is always there every year hosting the association that we two are members of, and we have a great time there. And Eston, hello, good to have you with us.
Yeah. Okay. What do you want me to talk about, Neil?
Well, I'd like to hear if you could tell us about some of the chief pilots, and we're going to talk about some of the other bases besides Atlanta.
Okay.
So who do you know? Go ahead.
Okay, I'll start out with the Charlotte base. I was hired in 1957, March, and I ended up and signed the Charlotte base and April 57, and when I arrived there, the chief pilot was Tony Harmon, a real fine gentleman, one of the early airmail pilots, and I was there all 2 years, and of course, I did my first year, which you're on probation, you know, and I had a couple experiences on probation. And one being that I was supposed to go out on a trip at 1 o'clock in the morning, so I thought I'd grab a few hours sleep before I had to check in. And so I had an electric alarm clock and was all set to get up. Well, what happened, we had a thunderstorm, and the power went out, my clock stopped, and I overslept. So I missed the trip. They were fortunate enough to find another co-pilot in the neighborhood, and they made the trip. But the next day, I was in the chief pilot's office, and here I am, my first year with Eastern. I'm on probation. And, again, Tony was a great gentleman, Tony Harmon. He said, well, tell me all about it. Tell me what happened. I told him, and he listened quite intently and was all over. He said, now, what you need to do so this won't happen again. In fact, he said, don't let this happen again until you've been a captain for 10 years at Eastern. He said, buy you one of those little alarm clocks that you wind up and use it for reserve in case the power goes out. And I never forgot that. And I still, if I really got to get up, I set more than one alarm clock, one electric and one wind up. That's one story. While I was still on probation, I took a trip to Havana, Cuba. Of course, this is before Castro. I flew down there in a Navion with a gentleman that owned it. And while I was down there, getting ready to head home, the weather in Florida, North Florida, turned real nasty, and I couldn't get back up to Charlotte. So I had to call in and tell them I was weathered in. And again, Tony was quite gracious with me, and he understood. And I spent all 2 years in Charlotte. I really loved it there. All the captains were fine gentlemen, and most of them had been World War II pilots. They were great pilots. They were quite relaxed all the time, and they were great instructors. And when you're a new co-pilot, you need a good instructor, believe me.
Yeah.
So,
Eston, I remember Charlotte when it closed down because they closed down the same time that Eastern also closed New Orleans. And at the time, if I'm not mistaken, John Clower was the chief pilot there. Wonderful man. And we became real good friends later on. And is that correct? Do you remember John Clowers being the chief pilot?
Yeah, but just before John was chief pilot, Jess Johnson was the chief pilot for a short time. And then later, John Clare. And
yeah.
I got a good story about Jess. He was quite a poker player, you know. And he taught me to play gin rummy. It only cost me, I don't want to say how much money, but it was quite a bit. But he taught me to play poker on the layovers.
His way. Yeah, very good.
Well, Neil, I got a little bit of a story about John Clower and that face closing thing, if you want to hear it.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. John's one of the best guys I've ever flew with. And, you know, as a young co-pilot, you always try to pick a captain. You want to try to be like when you get your fourth stripe and you check out as a captain. And John was one of those gentlemen. He was a great guy.
Absolutely. John Clower was my ideal as a captain. Tall, good looking, great guy, great, and nice southern guy too, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, they closed that base in New Orleans and Charlotte at the same time. You're absolutely correct. But what you didn't say was they cut Chicago in half, and I was in Chicago. So I had to go to New York, electric second officer, a flight engineer, they called us. We weren't second officers because it wasn't a real jet. And we had to go up there, and all these guys came up from from Charlotte, too. There was a whole bunch of us up there, and we bid and got Connie co-pilot. And we had to go to school in a hangar at Kennedy to learn how to be a Connie co-pilot. Well, I'd flown Connies in the Air Guard, so I knew about Connies, but still I had to go through the whole school and everything, of course. And we had one of those guys up there from Charlotte. We had a bunch of those guys, Joe Dissel, Dave Curran, Frank Mars, I can name them all over the place, plus some guys in Chicago, too, in that ground school class. And one of them, and I won't name him, but he had, you know, we had to get our flight engineers written passed or before we went off flight off probation, or we would not be kept on by Eastern Airlines. And we were sitting around up there one day, and we were talking about Charlotte and coming up there and all that kind of stuff. And this one guy said, yeah, you know, I was having a little trouble getting my idea that I had to go be a flight engineer, and I figured out the way to do it was to not get my flight engineer written pass. And they're not going to got all this invested in me. They'll figure out some way to keep me on, you know. And this guy was telling us this story, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, well, I've already got mine. I'm flying electric flight engine. All those guys in Chicago, we got it done, except one guy who got asked to resign. But we all got it done and everything. And this guy's telling me this story, and he's still here. And we were off probation by then. And I'm thinking, well, how in the world, what are you going on here? And I queried him as to, did you fly flight engine? Flight engineer in Charlotte, and all they didn't have an electric, but it doesn't matter. You know, they had Convairs. It didn't matter. You had to get it done, or you were not going to go off post. You were not going to make probation. And he said, I got a letter about a week out, 2 weeks out, from John Clower, chief pilot, said, come in, I want to see you. And I figured, well, I just won't go in, you know, and that'll be, you know, they're not going to let me go. I thought they got all this money invested in me, training on the Convair and all that. And he got another letter in his box and said, you come see me right now. And so he went in and saw John Clower. I mean, you know, John Clower is sort of a big guy. And he walked in and he said, have you got your flight engineer's written pass? And he said, well, no, sir. And he said, well, you will have it passed before next Thursday or whatever it was, a week away, or your ass is out of here. And he said, and besides that, I'm going to knock you upside the head. And he held his fist up. And this is the guy telling me the story. He said, I had that sort of rich pass in 4 days. John Clower was one of my favorite captains. I love
him. Yeah, he was. Fabulous, fabulous captain, pilot. We don't want to talk all about pilots tonight. When I first thought about doing this show, I thought about the crew bases, and most of the time the bases were the same for the flight attendants as they were for the pilots. So I asked Jim Holder, I said, how many, I count about 11, I think I said first, Jim, 11 crew bases, 13.
Yeah.
And I said, let's see how many you've got. And he came up with the same number. And so I said, well, name them. And he named a couple that I'd forgotten. But I thought I had done well in my research that Jacksonville, Florida, here where I live, was a long, long time ago, back in the 40s, a crew, a domicile for pilots. And I couldn't think of the chief pilot's name, and then it came to me, it was Rudy Seymour. I believe that was the person that was the chief pilot here. But Esten, you correct me because you know all of these folks. And do you remember Jacksonville, the crew base in Jacksonville?
Well, Jacksonville was before my time. It was not there. I was hired in 57, early 57. Jacksonville was not a crew base at that time. I heard some of the pilots talk about it. They were in Charlotte. They used to be there as co-pilots.
Yeah.
But I know nothing about it.
Well, Esten, the only reason I know about it is because my late friend John Engel, Admiral Engel, and also he was with Eastern Airlines for 42 years. He knew that because he was from Jacksonville. And he was also the regional manager, sales, and then became the manager of the field here in Jacksonville. And he told me about the crew base here. I think he told me that there were at one time 13 pilots. I believe there were about 13 pilots based here in Jacksonville. But some of the other bases, does anyone want to recite them? Either Jim Holder or Esten, who wants to take a shot at it? All the crew bases, and then we'll move over to maintenance because I know Chuck is standing by to tell us a little bit about maintenance bases. But does anyone want to, either one of you guys, want to tell us all the bases, the crew bases that we had chief pilot or pilots based?
Well, Neil had them all except one. He forgot Houston.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You're right. Well, since you mentioned that I didn't know that one, you tell us the rest of them, Jim Holder.
Oh, for God's sakes, I can't remember those
things. Take a shot at it. We'll...
Kennedy, Miami, Boston, Charlotte, Houston, Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, which was one. San Juan, I believe, was one for a very short period of time. And New Orleans, what else have I forgot? I don't know.
Charlotte, you said. Yeah.
Philadelphia.
Chicago.
Philadelphia, yeah. Chicago.
Hell,
Chicago. I was based there in New York. I forgot that.
George Jen, contribute the rest of them. Did we get them all?
I think you left out Kennedy, LaGuardia, and Newark.
That's right.
Oh, they all
three
won.
Of them.
They were Kennedy. JFK, yeah. Left on the bid award.
Were
that's
they?
On the bid award, George.
I thought they were separate.
No, sir. I was up there on the lector, and I flew out of all three bases while I was up there.
Correct.
I served a one-year sentence in New York before I could get out of that place.
You probably lived in the pilot ghetto, too, right, Jim?
What? What'd you say?
Did you live in the pilot ghetto there by LaGuardia?
No. Matter of fact,
I
lived in Little Ferry, New Jersey, and my oldest daughter was born in Hackensack, and she's still trying to live it down.
Esten, where were you first based? Chicago?
Well, I was first based in Charlotte, and I just talked
Charlotte.
About that. I was there 2 years, Neil, and then I moved up to Chicago. And the chief pilot at that time in Chicago was a Chuck Blanchard. Real nice gentleman, and then later Bud Payne, who moved down to Atlanta.
There's another gentleman. Wonderful.
Yeah,
man.
Oh, yes. When I went to Chicago, I was just qualified on the Martin and Convair, and I bid up there so I could get on the big four engines, you know. So within 6 months, I'd been to school on the DC-7, the Constellation, and also the Lockheed Electra. And I got the Electra way out of seniority, And the only reason being, the training was over Christmas. And after the ground school, they sent us out to St. Louis for the flight training, believe it or not. There was a, Eastern had a lecture late overnight there, so that's where we got the flight training. And the instructor was a Buzz Bismarck. I don't know whether you ever heard of him, but he was quite a powerful character. And anyway, my training, I went through training with the Joe Matthews in Chicago. And every night for 4 or 5 nights, we went out to the airport and spent a couple hours. And our second trip out there was quite exciting during the training. The first night, the check captain was in the right seat and give the captain a little time and let him get used to it. And then he let me up there for a while and give me a couple lines. Well, the second night we went out, the check captain said, look, I'm going to sit on the jump seat. And when I give you the signal on takeoff, I want you to pull the number 4 engine back. And I said, okay. So I'm watching him out of the corner of my eye. And on his signal, I pulled it back. And we were already past the V1 speed, the one where you're not supposed to try to stop. And also on this trip, there was an engineer getting his training with a check engineer standing behind him. Well, the student engineer did something he wasn't supposed to do. The only thing he was supposed to say was engine failure. But rather than just say engine failure, he said engine failure, and he reached up and pulled the number 3 shutdown, which shuts everything down that engine. And we've already got number 4 pulled back. Well, the old lecturer was immediately heading for the boondocks. But just out of instinct, I pushed number 4 back up, and we regained it and went out of there. And Buzz, the check captain, instructor, he bought me a drink that night and really thanked me. That didn't happen again. So that was quite exciting.
Yeah. But, you know, since I got you guys got great memories, and I've got a pick your memory about this this one. And I remember I did my initial flight training in the in New Orleans. And right after I came with Eastern, there was a crash in New Orleans, and Jim Talton was a captain on a layover there at the hotel right beside the Moisant Airport.
That was a Delta DC-8.
And it was a Delta DC-8. Do you guys recall that?
Training flight.
And were there deaths there, too, weren't there? I mean, that was a big, it was a crash. And
yeah, they landed on runway 36 to the north. It was a training flight. They hit that motel I talked about on my other story.
Yeah.
Right there on Airline Highway.
Airline Highway. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I got my question answered. Now, I want to bring in Chuck Albright, who is with maintenance there in Miami. And I think he also served some time in Atlanta. Chuck, are you still with us?
Oh, yeah. I'm here. Stories are very fascinating.
I know it. It really is. I'm enjoying the stories. You were in maintenance. You know, I was thinking about this program tonight. And then I thought, wouldn't it be great to talk about not only the pilot bases, the flight attendant bases, the maintenance bases, but also the reservation systems, because we had them all over the Eastern system. And so maybe we'll do a separate show on the Eastern reservation system, because it was the best of all the airlines. System 1, you recall that? System 1?
Yep, System 1.
Oh, yeah.
That was out of Doral.
Yeah, that's right. And they were at Salt Lake City. They were a lot of different places. We had reservation bases. But Chuck, tell us about the maintenance bases, if you would, please.
Well, I'd like to digress a little bit. Last couple of weeks, we've discussed how the airline industry and airplanes have progressed up the chain, so to speak. Obviously, the Wright brothers, they were pilots, but first of all, they were mechanics. As everybody knows, they had a bicycle shop, and so that gave them some of the background, the mechanical background, to be able to build their airplane. And like the Wright brothers, when everything started to progress, they didn't really have licensed mechanics. They had people who were mechanics that did other things, like them, bicycle shop, automobile mechanics that happened to go out to the airfield and work on the airplanes, and because a lot of the engines obviously have the same types of problems, and of course the engines are almost exactly, until you get into some of the radial engines and of course the jets later, but we're talking about, I would say, around May in 1928. We were talking about, we were awarded that CAM 25, which was out of Atlanta to Miami. And that was kind of the big deal back in those days of when maintenance actually started to grab hold as a kind of an independent part of the company. New York had come, you know, started to come of age at the same time, and of course all up and down the East Coast, as a lot of you know, my dad was with Eastern Airlines in 1937, and he was a what they call a field manager. He would open up fields, but he told me at the time he might have opened up Charlotte and saw a couple of the other places, and he had maybe one guy there that worked on airplanes. They didn't have an EMP license at the time, but he was their mechanic, their go guy. And a lot of the other small places like New Orleans you were talking about, in the same area, they just sprung up. I mean, the Eastern was just like plants growing during the Second World War. My dad opened up at least 7 to 10 stations during the Second World War. We moved around a lot. But after that, then you had some of the other stuff as time went along. And eventually, when you got into the 60s and 70s, then the maintenance base, the big maintenance bases started coming along. Obviously, Miami, Atlanta, New York, some of the other bases, Chicago, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denver, and of course you had the West Coast, LA, and San Francisco, and you were talking about the big three in New York, LaGuardia and Kennedy, came along, but as we discussed before, Miami and Atlanta was the big bases. This is because Atlanta was the big hub. Of course, they had a lot of the commuter airplanes, so to speak. Miami seems to settle in and had a lot of the larger planes as time went along. I personally was with the L-1011 program for about 8 years. I got a chance to be transferred to Atlanta because they thought that shuttling the planes down at night empty was costing a lot of money, the L-1011s. And so what they did was they wanted to keep the planes in Atlanta and do the turns there. Well, as it turned out, we had almost 4,000 people in Miami in that big rotunda building at the end of Eastern's maintenance complex on 36th Street, but only 20 men decided to move their families there. I happened to be one of them. And So consequently, that's how they wanted to go about dispersing the airplanes. 727s, DC-9s, and we're in Atlanta most likely. We had the 1011s, A300s, 757s, and we actually had the 747 and the DC-10. I happened to be got picked or volunteered or whatever you want to call it, to be a ground taxi and run-up mechanic. You had to be a master mechanic to do that, which means you had to be approximately 8 to 10 years with the company. At that time, I had a little over 12 years with the company. And so consequently, I got to taxi these planes, and that's one of the reasons that I got to go to Atlanta, because I knew how to taxi the L-1011s. Story of that later on. But as time went on, the bases started dispersing a lot of the feeder airplanes, the smaller ones, the DC-9s we got from some of the other airlines. And consequently, they needed mechanics. And they would not have the large mechanic fields to draw from. So places like St. Louis or something along those lines would only have one or two mechanics, and they would only work maybe one or two shifts. Wouldn't be a three-shift, seven-day operation sometimes. But that's how the Eastern had built this large network of maintenance throughout their whole system. Obviously, when they went overseas, when they started going overseas and got overseas contracts, what they did was is they farmed out the work, so to speak, to like when they went to London, BOAC and some of the other ones, they would hire their mechanics to work on our planes for whatever time it took, and then of course I guess the company had some kind of reciprocating payment agreement with these different airlines. I know when they went into some of the other places, they would use the local mechanics there. But and down in South America, they did the same thing. They would use the mechanics of the other airlines. I think the New Easterns is doing that down in South America. But eventually, as the airline expanded, we ended up, I believe, at their prime time, somewhere in the mid-1980s, we had close to, if I remember right, 14,000 mechanics. Now, those are different types of mechanics. Wow. You have, of course, you have your A&P mechanic that everybody knows about, and he's allowed to work on just about anything. But then they picked up licensed electricians, or they'd pick up licensed avionics, or they would keep people in the sheet metal shops. And they don't have any license at all. They would work under the license of the company. They couldn't work on the plane itself, so to speak, but they could work on ancillary, like floor panels and panels for the engines and stuff like that. But to actually go out and work out in the field or something over at the terminal, they didn't do that. And so consequently, the Miami and Atlanta base and the New York base got quite big. Unfortunately, as the time went on, as we all know, as the airline started to financially get into trouble, one of the things that they did do was cut back on a lot of these bases that were outlying bases that only had one or two mechanics. And those people either moved to bigger places like Atlanta or Miami, or unfortunately they lost their jobs. Consequently, a lot of these small bases we discussed before, like St. Louis, they actually closed up. One of the stories that I talked about here is when I got transferred to Atlanta, I was on the afternoon shift. There was only 20 of us, and they split us up into different crews on different shifts. And there was four of us sitting at a table waiting to get our assignment for the evening. And the foreman walked in, and said, you four guys are from Miami. And we said, yes, we are. And I understand you guys are all L-1011 mechanics. And we said, yes, sir. And he says, which one of you people have a taxi license? And before I could say anything, the other three guys pointed to me. And I knew they had taxi license too, but they didn't want to get involved with it. And what they did was I went outside, and at the end of the building was a wash rack. And throughout the afternoon, they had parked DC-9s all and 727s right in front of the hangar. Of course, there was a space there where they taxied them in and out. But what they had done is they had blocked this L-1011 in the wash rack, and they wanted it for the morning flight. And so the guy says, I need you to taxi this plane over to the terminal. I says, well, you can't get it out. It's all blocked in. He says, we've got that fixed up. I said, what is it? He says, I want you to taxi this plane and keep your right wing over the tops of the DC-9s and the 727s, and we're going to open the doors to the big hangar, and as you go down with the opening of the door, your wing will go inside the hangar a little bit, so we're going to shut the number one engine off. And then as we get close to where the doors are, we're going to turn you over around the top of a DC-9 to get you out of this fix. And I says, I don't think so. I think that sounded very dangerous to me. And the foreman says, we need the plane. I'll take the responsibility. And they must have had 20 people out of there directing me taxiing this plane. That was one of the scariest things that I ever did as a mechanic. But as time went along, the bases shrank. And, of course, everybody knows it all ended up with almost the same three bases ended up when they went bankrupt just about. And by the way, Neil, Jacksonville actually had maintenance personnel there at one time.
Yeah, and that was probably to maintain the Pitcairn mail wing. wonderful story, and I'd like to conclude that maintenance story, Chuck, by asking you, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to, and I think you know the answer. The granddaddy of the mechanics, or maintenance rather, I should say, the granddaddy of maintenance with Eastern Airlines was a gentleman known as
Ray.
Go ahead.
Johnny Ray.
Johnny Ray.
And I had lunch with him.
Wow. He was almost as famous as, with Eastern Airlines that is, as Eddie Rickenbacker.
He was a grand old man. I sat there. This is after I got promoted later on to tech service. That's where the pilots have run out of things to do. They call tech service and want us to tell them which light to turn off. But anyway, I went down there for lunch because my office was right on the corner of 36th Street and Lejeune Road. What's that number? 5 building, I think it is.
Yeah, building.
And I went downstairs to the lunchroom on 36th Street, and I was sitting there by myself, and here comes Johnny Ray with his tray, and he says, you mind if I sit with you, young man? I said, oh, no. And I knew who he was, and I was in complete awe with him. And he started telling me stories you wouldn't believe.
Was he smoking a cigar?
They didn't let him smoke in the lunchroom.
Yeah, he smoked a cigar, but lots of stories of Eastern history dealt with Johnny Ray, and a great friend of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. And
yes, he was.
I believe he came over from Pitcairn, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he had number one mechanic's number.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember that being in Eastern newspaper.
Great, great, great stories. Thanks so much, Chuck, for your maintenance dialogue, your information about maintenance. I learned so much tonight, and really, it's a great show. And we've got a few more minutes. We've got, as a matter of fact, several more minutes. So I want to ask any of our callers, because we've got our boards completely lit up. We can only accommodate, as I've mentioned several shows in the past, that we can only accommodate about 15 callers that are live that call in, that we see their number, and some are listening because that's the way they choose to listen to our shows. Instead of going to the computer, they simply call in 213-816-1611, and they just listen. That's fine. We want that. If that's the way you feel more comfortable listening to the EAL radio show, then so be it. We want you to listen in that way. But if you'd like to ask any questions, I'm going to open all the microphones. It's hard to filter out any background noise, as I've mentioned in the past. So we accept all telephone calls in the background, glasses with ices in the glass, or doorbells, or children crying, or dogs barking, because this is kitchen table radio. We can't filter that out. So we just open all the microphones and hear what whatever comes from your microphone, which is your telephone. So I'm opening all the microphones up, and if anyone would like to contribute to anything that you've heard so far, this is a time, because we've got some more stories to talk about. Dead air time. I hear dead air time. It's like a printer without ink for the newspaper.
What do we have to do to, do we just jump in and say what we want to say?
You're doing exactly what we want to do, we'll want to hear. Go right ahead and say what you want to say. Who is this?
Great. I just want to tell you that this is my very first time, and I am absolutely thrilled and delighted that a friend of mine clued me in on this. And the only suggestion I might have is that there might be a synopsis of the current situation of Eastern today, because I know we're all very excited about what's happening with Eastern. And, you know, if you could just take a couple of minutes to give us an update. My name is Dorothy, and when I was flying, my name was Dorothy Gamalik. And I do want to say that Christine Mink flew with Eastern, and then when they mentioned the 10/11, she was one of the first. She went to London for her training, and she passed away a year ago. And she was she flew for Eastern for, I don't know, 30 some odd years. And So I know a lot of you out there must have known Chris. She was based for a long, long time in Chicago. So, but anyway, thank you so much for this. And I'm going to call my friend Madge McGordy that clued me in on this program, because I really enjoyed listening to it. Thanks. Bye.
Dorothy, don't hang up. Please don't hang up. But we hope you listen.
I won't hang up.
The rest of the show.
I was just signing off.
Okay, sign off. Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling and being a first-time caller. And we're happy that you found our spot on Cyber Radio. It's not a ground station, and people ask us, are you on FM or AM? No, we're on Cyber. So thanks so much for calling. And, yeah, we do talk about the new Eastern Airlines and what's happening there. We usually have that, Dorothy, during the end of our show. Sometimes we call it breaking news, and we tell over the air what we know. Some of it we have to research. We sometimes we have a caveat also that check it out. Sometimes we hear rumors, lots of rumors about the new Eastern, and we want to make sure that we're not giving wrong information on our broadcast. So we've got just a few more minutes, and we'll be into breaking news. Dorothy normally handles that part of it, and maybe Dorothy can bring us up onto the latest of what's happening with Eastern. So bear with us, Dorothy. Thank you so much. There are two Dorothy.
Thank you so much. And then one more thing I'd like to say is that I gave you my maiden name, which was many, many years ago. My married name is Dorothy Newhan, and I am a silver liner. I've been a silver liner since 1973. We love Eastern Airlines, and we do everything we can here in Detroit, Michigan. We have a silver liner flight to the North Pole. This year we had 74 kids, 74
wow.
young children between the ages of 3 and 9 years old that have life-threatening illnesses, and we do everything we can. We still tout the name of Eastern Airlines.
That's so important, Dorothy, that you and others have carried on this legacy that we have, and that's what we're trying to do here on the radio show. But folks like the Silver Liners, which, by the way, I think we have, Dorothy, we have a show that is dedicated to the Silver Liners.
Dorothy,
are you with us?
I'm with you, and I've heard that. And I am a former president of the Silver Liners International.
Okay, Dorothy Gagnon, can you talk about that, Dorothy, just for a minute?
What would you like to know?
Yes, sure.
Oh,
we have
there are two Dorothys
liners.
Here.
Wait a minute, I hear a voice that sounds familiar. It might be Connie.
We've got Dorothy Gagnon on right now, Dorothy. So listen to what she has to say about the Silver Liners show a couple of weeks from now.
Well, we have the Silver Liners scheduled for episode 315 on Monday, April 24th, where we honor the Silver Liners as our featured guests. We have Connie Lee Kerrigan, who is the president right now of the Silver Liners International, along with former presidents Carol Harlan, who actually is age 93, and that's wonderful. And we have the Silver Liners founder and the member of the MCO chapter, Jeannie Fitzgerald Smith. We will
Great.
Also have the first elected president, which was Beverly Bridges Bennis.
Yes.
And then former presidents Claudia Tangi Van Veen and Lois Gershel Morton. Lois, as a matter of fact, was responsible for the Silver Liners' participation with Paul Newman for his hole-in-the-wall gang venture.
Yes,
so that roundtable is going to be on April 24th, and they're going to recapture the history, the charitable, and the social endeavors that they have. So please join us then, and we'd love to have you on, actually. So contact Connie Kerrigan and arrange to be with her, Dorothy. That would be great.
I will do that. Thank you.
And, Dorothy, you know our phone number, so just make sure you call back, okay?
Will not forget you.
Okay. Golly, where can you hear about Eastern Airlines as you do here on the EAL radio show? And, of course, we've got to mention we have the Associations of Retired Eastern Pilots Association, which Captain Jim Holder is the editor of the magazine there and keeps everyone informed with the pilot side. And we have the Silver Liners, which we're going to hear about 2 weeks from now on the 24th. We have EARA, and we have Michael Zoll, the president there. And we've heard from that organization in the past. So we want to share all of the information and news, the latest news, and hopefully we'll get someone to represent the new Eastern Airlines group and tell us what's happening with the new Eastern Airlines, and that's what we're hoping to be able to present to our listeners in the future. Golly, Pete, anybody want to make a comment? I know Jim Holder, you know, we said we're going to do an interview with Paul Kelly, Captain Paul Kelly. I talked with Paul, and he was sharing with me so many stories about the former, well, the past presidents before he was the chief pilot in Atlanta. And I thought you did a wonderful job of interviewing Paul in the REPA magazine, Retired Eastern Pilots Association magazine. It's about a 5-page interview. And Jim, forgive me, but we just don't have time to do that tonight.
No, we don't. We gotta postpone this, or we'll be cutting off right in the middle of it.
Yeah, caught in the middle of it, but we'll do it again. That's what this radio show is all about. It's bringing the news of interest. Go ahead, Jim.
Neil, I do have a war story, if I can tell a war story, and I think at the end of it you'll appreciate why I want to tell this story.
Go.
Do I have your permission to tell about the trip from hell?
Go for it.
Okay.
Just waterproof.
All right.
Yeah.
It's waterproof, yeah. Listen, this goes back to about 1975, and once again, I'm this eager young co-pilot, first officer on the 727. This is a trip from hell. You got to listen to it. And the second officer was Terry McDonald, and the captain shall remain anonymous, at least now. And we're scheduled to go from Atlanta to Pittsburgh to Buffalo to Toronto, back to Buffalo, back to Pittsburgh, back to Atlanta, and down to Mobile all in one day. And we took off from Atlanta to do that. And it was in the middle of the winter. And we had a jump seat rider named Jim Sandusky. You remember Jim? His brother Chad Sandusky was also an Eastern pilot. Captain.
Absolutely.
And so we take off, and Jim wants to go to Pittsburgh, the jump seat rider. So we take off. Pittsburgh, it's snowing, it's a mess. The whole Midwest is a mess. We get to Pittsburgh, and we can't land. It's below minimums, blizzard going on, and all that kind of stuff. So we go to Buffalo, and we're on final at Buffalo, and an American 727 gets sideways on the runway and slides off the runway, half on. We can't land at Buffalo. So we go to Toronto, and now we're sitting in Toronto with all the people that wanted to go to Pittsburgh and wanted to go to Buffalo are now in Toronto. And all the people in Toronto want to go to either Buffalo, Pittsburgh, or Atlanta. I don't think anybody wanted to go to Mobile. I'm telling you the truth. This is the damnest thing I've ever got involved in. And so we're sitting up there, and it's about 5 below zero. The wind's blowing. It's terrible weather in Toronto. And we're sitting there, and they're trying to figure out who gets off the airplane and who gets on the airplane. You've got to imagine, we got people that never been to Canada are now in Canada. And all the trouble that makes up, man, it was a hell of a mess. I'm not kidding you. So they finally get it all figured out on who's going to get on the airplane, which is practically nobody, and try to take the people back to Buffalo that want to go to Buffalo. And you got to remember, Jim Sandusky's still on the jump seat, and all he wanted to do was go to Pittsburgh. So we finally get up, and we get cranked up, and we go to push back. And you got to remember, it's about 5 degrees above or below zero. It doesn't make the difference. It's still cold. And we push back, and we stop. And the guy on the tractor says, "We just had a tire go flat." Oh, my Lord. And so Terry McDonald, to this day, if he walked in this room, he'd say, "It wasn't flat on the walk around." And that's all I heard was he said, "It wasn't flat on the walk around." And so, well, that was the end of that. So now we pushed back up. Now these guys have got a change of tire. We're so late, and we got people that don't know where they are, where they're going. It's the biggest mess you've ever seen. And so about an hour and a half or 2 hours late, they come up and try to get warm in the aircraft because they're freezing to death out there trying to change a tire. And they finally, it's snowing, it's still snowing, snowing like mad. And they finally get the tire changed, and we push back, and lo and behold, all the tires stayed full. They didn't go flat. So we taxi out, and, of course, the captain made the first takeoff, but we didn't land anywhere except at Toronto. So now he says, "It's your leg, Jim." So we get out on the end of the runway, and we got all these people that don't know where they are or where they're going, and I'm not sure we did either. And so we go roaring down the runway, and I rotate the airplane. Number 3 engine goes pow like that and backfires, and the captain hollers out engine failure. And we climb out, you know, you climb out to 1,000 feet, lower the nose and all that. And the Kerry McDonald hollers, yes, it's number three, it's number three. And so I push the nose over at 1,000 feet. And, of course, we have the ignition on. You know how that is. And the thing lights off again. The engine starts spooling back up again. And what happened was all the snow on the wings went back and hit that number three engine, and it killed it. But we had continuous ignition, so it lit back off again. So, boy, we said, God almighty, thank God we didn't lose the engine. We just lost it for about 10 seconds. So now we go to Pittsburgh, and lo and behold, we can get into Buffalo. And we get into Buffalo, and now all the people are shell-shocked. They get off, and people in Buffalo that wanted to go to Toronto, I think, have rented cars and long gone. And now we go to Pittsburgh, and we're turning final out there at Pittsburgh, and we got smoke in the cockpit. It's stinking and smelling, and what the hell's going on here, you know? And we lost, one of the compass systems between Buffalo and Pittsburgh. We're operating on one compass system. You know, remember, you could switch back and forth. And we land, and it's hot smoke coming in, and we did everything but declare an emergency, and maybe we did. I don't even remember by now. And we taxi in, and they come out, and, of course, Jim Sandusky finally gets off the airplane in Pittsburgh about 10 hours after he thought he was going to. And now they come out, and they look, and they say, well, your battery charger has gone bad. It overheated the battery, and that's all it is, Cap. Don't worry about it. And of course, we're all sitting there, don't know what the hell's going on. We're so late now, it doesn't even make sense. So they put a new battery charger in. They put a new battery in, and we crank up, and lo and behold, we go to Atlanta without any emergency. I mean, it's to believe. We get to Atlanta about 1 in the morning when we were supposed to be getting to Mobile about 8 in the afternoon, 8 the night. And we land. Of course, they'd already stood up the flight out. You know, we got back to Atlanta. We were through. We didn't have to go to Mobile. And I wanted to tell this story. And as somebody on this radio net remembers it, do you know what, Neil?
What?
Your captain? Who was the captain?
Who was the captain?
Eston Fuller.
Oh,
you hear that, Eston? You remember that trip?
You didn't have to tell that.
Eston Fuller was the captain on that flight.
Well, let me tell you one. Can I tell one good story?
One good story. Go ahead, Eston.
Okay. Sometime in March, it must have been, I know it was, 64. I got assigned an electric trip out of Atlanta, and it stopped in Palm Beach going on to Miami. Well, en route to Palm Beach, one of the flight attendants came up to the cockpit wanting to sign her name in the logbook, you know. So I turned around, and it was the most beautiful blonde I'd ever seen. So I asked her what her name was, and she told me. And then she wanted to know my name, but she didn't believe it. But she'd heard so much stories around about me, you know. Well, anyway, long story short, that turned out to be my wife. And still got her after it'll be 53 years now, this coming August.
Congratulations. She's still beautiful.
Memorable trip.
Still beautiful.
Linda is still beautiful. You're right.
Her name is Linda, and she was flight attendant, of course, and she was a silver liner for a while, but since we didn't live around any of the big cities, she don't belong anyplace. That's my good story.
Oh, no, that's a true story. Linda, are you with us tonight?
Linda, are you on?
We can hear you,
I've been
Linda.
I've been taping this whole program.
Oh, good. Well, I tell you what, you are a beautiful lady, and we all agree with Eston. Eston, you're a very lucky guy.
I know.
Now,
I know.
When Eastern Airline pilots tell you you're that kind of a compliment, that goes through the sky. That's a biggie.
Well, it's very true.
I'll just tell you that I'm a small town girl from Indiana, and Eastern Airlines drastically changed my life, and I will always be grateful, always.
Well, Linda, it changed everyone that to ever work for Eastern Airlines Light, and we're so happy that we're a family. And if you listen after we sign off tonight with our good night theme song that we do every night, we're going to have a song that says we are family, and that's what we are, family. And it's
that's really good.
Yeah. It's I tell you what, the shows like tonight, this is a great show tonight. It really is. We've left a lot out. We like to do more, and we don't want to bore people. But golly, the stories we've heard tonight, that I just think they're great. And
I don't think you have to worry about anybody being bored.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Linda. Folks like you and Dorothy and our callers, and we've got so many callers on the board that are not even talking tonight, because and if you'd like to, we've got up until about 15 more minutes, because I schedule about an hour and a half for our show tonight, and I don't want it to be boring. We want to talk about Eastern Airlines and stories like we've had tonight, both flight and maintenance, and we want to hear more flight attendant stories and reservation stories and ground personnel stories. And so we're getting there, but we thank you very much for your listening, all of our listeners for listening tonight. And any other discussion that we want to talk about before we hit to breaking news, or is that
just
about time?
One of the things, Neil.
Yeah,
one of the
ahead,
things.
John.
Remember the time the parrot got loose in the cockpit?
The what got loose in the cockpit?
The parrot, the paw parrot.
The parrot.
The bird.
The bird. I don't remember that one.
Well, we'll have to tell it next time. It's pretty long.
Oh, okay. If it's a long story. Probably
I remember
a
monkey got loose on a tiny freighter, I think. I heard a story about monkey in the cockpit, but not a parrot.
In a 757, it got loose. Yeah, 757, it got loose out in Oregon. Yeah. Portland,
I've just about run out of tape. Can you please save it for next time?
We'll do that. Yeah, very good. we've got a lot of announcements, and I want to hear right now. We've got all sorts of sound effects, but I talk a lot, but I try to also operate this board here. I've got a board here that shows all of the callers that we have, and I try to do the volume and all that stuff. But right now, I want to try to hit this little key here that will sound like this. And you know what that is. Breaking news. Dorothy, that's your cue.
That's a breaking news on our website that would like you to go to www.ealradioshow.com. Have Emory Riddle Aeronautical University is putting on an aviation safety and security archives. Christina Negroni. Now, Christina was one of our recent guest hosts on our broadcast, so be sure to look on the breaking news, and it will give you the time and place. She's going to be speaking, and she's going to be talking about aviation safety. She is the author of Human or Hazard, The Role of a Pilot in Aviation Safety. And as you know, we've had that program on a while back, and we intend to do a little bit more later on. We also have a vision on there that became real. B-29 that takes to the air. We had one video that we put on there showing the B-29 actually in flight. And this video here is all about Doc's friends that give an inspiring story as to how they made this vision a reality. And it was sent in by one of our listeners on the radio. We also have the first woman pilot that we have a little caption.
I just lost it.
The other thing that we have also is about the Eastern base at Lord
Dahat. I plugged my charger in.
And that too can be seen on our website. Things that I did put on the website also, as of we've gotten a lot of calls and listeners that want to know what's going on with Ed Weigel. I put a little blurb on there about AVI 8, and it's underneath the news section. He tells how he and Ray Sison got together to start up their AVI 8 leasing company. As far as the New Eastern goes, schedules that they have, but we don't have anything about a merger or any of that information. We haven't seen anything around. We don't know anything more to tell you other than what we had heard as the rumors before. Scheduling from that they work with constantly, and that's with Miami. They go from Miami to Camagüey, and then they go from Key West to Havana. They're also going into different areas in Cuba many times during the week. It's almost like a seven-day schedule, really, when you look at it, as well as the Bahamas and some other countries that they're going to, Trinidad and Costa Rica. They're moving around. They got their planes in the air, and you also see Facebook with Mark Carden and Wanda Stoll, a lot of our former Eastern people that were with Eastern that have now gone to Eastern Airline, and they talk constantly about where they're going and what they're doing. So they're very active, but we don't know how many planes they still have. We don't really know anything more to tell you other than that. So basically, we'll give you the information as we get it, but right now that's about all we have on that issue. So go to the website, take a look. There's a lot of different things up there that you can look at. I will try to get the air show photos that we took there up on the website this week for you to peruse and look through, and it has quite a bit. So we're looking to please you in any way we can. And if you have any comments, please write us at EALradioshow.com. Back to you, Neil.
Okay, very good.
Neil, Dorothy, Jim here. I had lunch with a guy today with Jerry Frost and some other guys, and one of the guys got his cell phone and told it to me, and I don't know if Dorothy mentioned this or not with the breakups we've been having just here, but that one of New Eastern's airplane was being sent to Europe with some carrier over there. Dorothy, have you heard anything about that? They even gave the tail number.
May I address that, Jim, Dorothy? We get a lot of email. We get a lot of stuff on Facebook, and we don't want to put it out on the radio unless we know we've checked. And Dorothy does a very good check on things before we broadcast, because we don't want to put out any wrong information. We're live, and you don't want to put it in the repartee either unless you've checked it out and you know that it's true. But we've heard those rumors. And so we don't talk about them until we really find out exactly. Right, Dorothy? You do it.
Right, exactly. I've seen rumblings, but I haven't seen anything concrete to really say. And sometimes people think that they see the plane or they've seen something that looks like the plane or whatever. But until I have a little bit more that I can say who saw what and whatever, I can't really comment on it. Before I do let everyone go tonight, I really do want to mention one more thing. We had a request from Colleen Petit, which she has been on our program in the past as one of our guest hosts. She's a pilot, and she's in the process of getting her PhD, which she's working on, and she's gathering a survey data from commercial pilots that she'd like some assistance on if there are any pilots out there that can help her. They have certain requirements, however. The problem that she sees is that every time there's an accident or an incident, they blame the pilot. So she wants to gather data on the contributing factors with training, safety culture, understanding, aviation fashion, and automation uses. The requirements that she needs for people to participate is a commercial pilot, an airline, charter, or corporate, with a crew complement with at least two pilots. They can be retired or between jobs if they were actively employed under the above conditions within the previous calendar year. They can't be an instructor or check airman for their primary employer. However, if they are a flight instructor or an evaluator on their days off, they qualify to participate. So anyone can email Carleen at Carleen Pettit, that's K-A-R-L-E-N-E, dot capital P-E-T-I-T-T at gmail.com to let her know that you're willing and able to help her, and so she really would appreciate anything that you could do, and she'll try to maybe later on talk about the research and share the details with us. So again, that's Carleen Pettit at gmail.com. Back to you, Neil.
Dorothy, thanks so much. We've just almost run out of time here, so we want to land the airplane. And what a great show tonight. I'm going to have to start scheduling 2 hours. We're almost up against our end time here of 90 minutes, an hour and a half. And, wow, what a show we've had tonight. It's been great. It really has. And we're going to do this breaking news at the end of our shows. And so listen in and find out the breaking news, or either go to, like Dorothy said, www.ealradioshow.com and look at the breaking news there. And it's great. A couple of shows coming up. We're going to do Orlando, Eastern Airlines, and the Magic Kingdom next Monday. Think you'll enjoy that show. So listen in, please. Great show. Jim Hart, how about taking us out of here? I'll give you some good night.
I'm standing by. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for tonight. Captain Chuck, how about putting Eastern 313 gently back on the runway?
Well, Chuck, are you still with us?
I'm here. I got it. Gatwick Tower, this is Eastern 313 Heavy. We're about 15 miles lined up for a straight-in runway 8 right. If that's okay, I've got the runway in sight.
Now, I'm going to say Eastern 310 Heavy, this is Gatwick Tower. You're clear to land on runway 8 right. The winds are light and variable from 060 degrees to 080 at 10 miles per hour. And the present temperature of the airport is 72 degrees Fahrenheit, 22 degrees Celsius. And a special welcome, Eastern, to London, England. We're happy to see you here.
Roger. Thanks, Gatwick. Eastern 313 Heavy is cleared to land runway 8 right. From all the people of Eastern Airlines, we're happy to be here.
Jim Hart?
I'm waiting for the good night music. Great car and great landing, Captain. Great show of Eastern memories. past and present. Mr. Producer, another outstanding job on the board. You know, it's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines or the new Eastern Airlines and the place we work and the stories we share. We feel we truly earn the title of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. And it's all because of you, our callers, our listeners, our guest host, and our sponsor, RETA, R-E-T-A, Retired Eastern Pilots Association. We look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us again April 17, 2017, as we file a flight plan for a destination yet to be determined. Until then, we all say good night, Eastern.
Eastern.
We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern. We love you.
We love you, Eastern.